Welcome. My name is Andy Garst. I'm the president of Prairie, a member of Prairie. Prairie aspires to be a welcoming church, both open-minded and open-hearted. We welcome you regardless of your religious or ethnic backgrounds. We strive to be a church that cares about you, your pronouns, your everything. We welcome you regardless of your strengths and weaknesses. In a world where you may not feel valued, know that you are valued here. If this is your first time to Prairie, I hope you'll come back because our programs can vary quite a bit. The programs can be done by our part-time minister, Sandy Ingram. They can also be offered by the wider community, and some, like today's program, is presented by a member of the congregation. Since this is my first program, I hope you'll have your understanding if this program does not rise to the typical level. Today's program is about an American composer, John Cage. John is one of the most influential composers of the 20th century. He slowly discovered his mission to demolish the crucial features of classical music. And he executed his plan with fervor and humor. His reputation and influence hinge more on his writing and his lectures than his compositions. I hope you'll enjoy today's program. I have an announcement here. The annual service auction is Sunday morning, March 4th. Right here, there will be a light brunch and lots of fun bidding on activities and events offered by the members and friends of Prairie. Contact Patty Stockdale with your items to sell. Email is on the thing. Patty Stockdale, I'm sorry. There you are. And now I'd like to turn it over to Catherine Liu.
Sit over here.
All right, so the opening words are from a 2004 essay called John Cage Defined the 50s. Joe Dacey describes John's lecture on nothing. And I quote, "In this lecture, he outright tells the listener that the lecture has no point and will go nowhere." He quotes John Cage, "I am here and there is nothing to say. If among you are those who wish to go somewhere, let them leave at any moment." John Cage implores the audience to enjoy each and every moment of the lecture, even though he admits it is pointless. He advocates that our poetry is now the realization that we possess nothing. Anything, therefore, is a delight, since we do not possess it, and thus need not fear its loss. And it is not irritating to be where one is. It is only irritating to think one would like to be somewhere else.
And then you and guys are doing the chalice lighting, right? Oh, no, I do my music next. Okay. The next piece is going to be a little odd. It's a musical piece where I just talk. It's a piece that I listen to frequently. It's one that I sort of think about as my church music. It starts out when I step out the door and I listen to the sounds of the yard outside, to the sound of the key going into the hole and turning the latch, the crunch of the snow as I walk to my car and open the door, the soft purr of the engine as it starts, and as the car rolls down the driveway onto the street. The sounds of the city as I drive closer and closer to church, the traffic. When I get to church, there's the sound of opening my car door and the steps towards the church. As I get closer, I start to hear the voices of different church members. Once the service starts, there's kind of also a lull and a crescendo as all the focus is focused on the speaker. After the service is done, there's another brouhaha as we talk and mingle amongst ourselves. And it slowly fades as I walk towards my car, open the door, and drive home again.
And shut the door.
For the chalice lighting. Questions. Why do all cultures have music? What is music? How do we define music? What purpose does it serve?
John Cage was a composer, musician,
music theorist, philosopher, and a mushroom expert. From his 20s till his death, he was a leading figure in the avant-garde. In 2012, The New Yorker had an article titled "The John Cage Century," marking John Cage's 100th birthday. In it, Alex Ross writes, "He remains a palpably vivid presence, still provoking thought, still spurring argument, still spreading sublime mischief. He may have surpassed Stravinsky as the most widely cited, the most famous and or notorious of 20th century composers. His influence extends far outside classical music into contemporary art and pop culture," end quote. For most people, if they know of John Cage at all, it is through his composition, 4 Minutes and 33 Seconds. In it, musicians sit by their instruments, quietly, for 4 minutes and 33 seconds. The content of the composition is not 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence, as is often assumed, but rather to focus your ears to the sounds of the environment. The composer and scholar Kyle Gann defines 4 minutes and 33 seconds as an act of framing, of enclosing environmental and unintended sounds in a moment of attention, in order to open the mind to the fact that all sounds are music. That last thought, that all sounds are music, ran through Cage's life. He wanted to discard musical rules and expectations from the past, open doors to the exterior world. "Let sounds be just sounds," he said. In 2004, the BBC Symphony Orchestra, in a packed concert hall, performed 4 minutes and 33 seconds. 4 minutes and 33 seconds of the sound of a quiet concert hall televised throughout Britain. 4 minutes and 33 seconds was not a gag for John Cage. It was a very serious piece. 3 years before his death in 1992, he told an interviewer, "No day goes by without my making use of that piece. I don't sit down to do it. I turn my attention outward. I turn my attention towards it. I realize that it is going on continuously."
Let me first apologize to Penny and all of you. The order of service is a little bit off. I was constantly redoing this thing last 2 days, so it's a little off. Not so long ago, the piece, 4 minutes and 33 seconds, generated a fun legal debate on the possibility of copywriting silence. As mentioned before, the debates over John Cage continue. Some argue that he should be considered a sculptor of sound, not a composer. Some argue that he should be considered, others think that his conceptual underpinnings of his various works will live on, but the compositions themselves will not. While others think that he's a total fraud, that by suggesting that all sounds are music, the word music loses its meaning. Still others not only found the conceptual underpinnings of his compositions fascinating, but many of the pieces beautiful as well. In The New Yorker, Alex Ross wrote in an article called "Searching for Silence," "Nearly 6 decades after the work came into the world, 4 minutes and 33 seconds is still dismissed as an absolutely ridiculous piece. Stupid. A gimmick. The emperor wears new clothes." Such judgments are especially common within classical music, where John, who died in 1992, remains an object of widespread scorn. In the visual arts, though, he long ago achieved monumental stature. He is considered the co-inventor of happenings and performance art. In the flutus movement, I've never heard of this one, but whatever, some art
Fluxus.
Movement. Flautus?
Fluxus.
Fluxus. Okay, apparently you've heard of it. Movement essentially rose out of some of the classes Mr. Cage taught at the New School in the late 50s. To listen to Cage's music, you need to throw out the expectations that sound will follow any pattern or tonal system. And yet the pieces remain tightly bound to the constraints of his composition. Surprisingly, for a person who employs randomness, John did not tolerate improvising by the musicians. Again, he wanted everything to stay within the constraints of the composition. To listen to John Cage's music, you need to throw out the expectations that sounds will follow any pattern or tonal system. To listen to John Cage's music, you might want to view it as a piece of sculpture. Appreciate every moment on its own, and each sound on its own terms as you walk around the piece. Okay, now we have hopefully a musical composition. Let me see what my order of service says. I believe that's next. Yeah, this is where we're going to do the John Cage meets Prairie. So if I can have Aaron and Catherine up. And this is a piece that I composed about 3 days ago. It's probably my first composition in about 30 or some years. And it's, I haven't heard it yet, so it's going to be pretty bad. Okay, so we got three people here. And I'll bring over a chair. You guys can spit on them, right? You can scoop the whole thing over there, right? Okay, there we go. Okay, so you're going to be Aaron.
Okay.
Okay, there you go. Read it over and sort of get yourself familiar with it. And, so it's basically going to be three parts, right? So you're going to start out with note 18. You're going to start it 0 seconds after it starts. And no, yours is over here.
Oh, I'm
going to
three.
Yeah, three, right? And you're going to start out with 18, right? Okay. And you know how to count out seconds and stuff like that, right? Okay, so you're going to start us off here, Aaron. I was very tempted to do a randomization of the program, but lucky for all you all, it didn't happen. Okay. John Cage was tall, thin. A large smile dominated his face. He was quick to laugh. He was warm, gentle, curious, whimsical, and with a strong undercurrent of humility. He had a thin voice that seemed to hang there slowly and fade like the Cheshire Cat. John Cage Jr. was born in Los Angeles in September 1912. The only child of Crete and John Cage Sr. His father was a fairly successful inventor, but unfortunately he was very poor at monetizing or commercializing his ideas. As an example, in 1913, he came out with an early submarine that he developed, the Peacekeeper. It was a financial flop because of his insistence not to hide the exhaust bubbles that would come up from below. He thought this was a safety feature, so if something happened, the people would know where to look. John's mother was active in clubs, starting a few and being active participant. But at home, John remembers his mother as never being happy. In the car ride, she would talk openly about the people that she did not like and did not want to see. On several occasions, his mother would leave the house announcing she would never come home. She always did. During John's second year in college, he grew disgusted with the educational system and quit. He then convinced his parents that traveling through Europe would be a far better education. There he studied architecture, painting, writing, and wrote his first musical compositions. After 18 months in Europe, John returned to California and started looking for people to mentor him and his compositions. With no money but a lot of confidence, he was able to talk his way into becoming a pupil for a few of the big name composers at the time, the last being Arnold Schoenberg. Schoenberg was one of the leading avant-garde composers at the time and had recently relocated to California from Europe to avoid Jewish persecution. It was during this time that John, an open homosexual and in an era of experimentation, decided to get married. After he left his tutelage with Schoenberg, he got a job with Cornish College up in Seattle. He and his wife, Zena, moved to Seattle. And John taught music composition and musically accompanied their dance troupe. This time was particularly productive. John assembled a percussion ensemble and toured the Northwest. This increased his exposure and fame. This was also the time John came up with the idea of a prepared piano. And I'm not sure if many people here know about the idea of a prepared piano, but it's an idea of mixing piano and percussion by placing items within the strings. And we'll be listening to a piece of that later. Not by me. In the belief that each object had its own sacred voice. This included found objects, but also modern objects as well, such as the sound of 12 radios. John envisioned a future where electronics would make all the sounds possible. This is also the time he first met Mercer Cunningham, a dancer. Cunningham would become a leading choreographer in modern dance and become John's longtime partner, romantically and professionally. After around 2 years at Cornish, he and Zena left for San Francisco, where he picked up some teaching opportunities at Mill College. From there, teaching classes at the Chicago School of Design, and from there, moving to New York City. When he gets to New York, he starts working with Mercer again, and his marriage unravels. In 1945, John and Zena separate and then divorce. The collapse of his marriage and his need to resolve his sexual identity sent John into an emotional tailspin. There was, on top, a growing concern about the purpose of music. If the purpose of music or art is to communicate, then there is a problem. Because people rarely understand what the artist was trying to say. John said, "If I were communicating, then all artists must be speaking a different language, and thus speaking only for themselves." The whole situation struck me more and more as a Tower of Babel. He decided to stop composing. unless he could come up with a reason other than communication. If John had not composed another piece of music, he would have been remembered as a significant composer. But how he resolved this dilemma was what pushed him to the next level. While exchanging musical lessons with a woman from India, he asked her what her teacher considered the function of music. She replied, "The purpose of music is to sober and quiet the mind, thus making it susceptible to divine influences." The purpose of music is to sober and quiet the mind, thus making it susceptible to divine influence. To John, this meant sobering and quieting of the mind meant to reduce the influence of the composer, to reduce the activity of the composer. In the divine influences, everything around him, all the noises, all the tastes, all the sights. The world was his divine influence. John took that and ran. He consumed all that he could about Eastern religions and philosophy. During this time, John started going to lectures by Suzuki, a Japanese citizen who had spent a couple of decades in America introducing people to Zen Buddhism. John said, "I don't study music from just anybody. I studied with Schoenberg. Likewise, I didn't study Zen with just anybody. I studied it with Suzuki." Zen provided a meaning for John's life, a purpose that it rarely, that really improved his compositional intelligence and his emotional health. John started using indeterminacy in his compositions. The amount of indeterminacy grew over time, and he started to use I Ching. He would come up with questions to ask the I Ching that would determine the course of different compositions. It is the use of this indeterminism that had set his work apart. What makes his works, it's what makes his work ask the big questions. What is music? And what purpose does it serve? I'm missing a page here. Okay. Victor Hugo said, "Music expresses that which cannot be said, and on which it is impossible to be silent." When I was in college, there was a group of students and faculty that did an experimental music performances. They did one called A Little Light Dinner Music. In it, they would usher in the audience in groups of four. Inside, they had a restaurant look. Lots of round tables and four chairs, tablecloths, plates, silverware, flowers. As each group of four was seated, they would be presented with a menu to look over. The menu consisted of different snippets of sound. Once everyone at the table had their order ready, the waiter would come over, take their order back to the kitchen. The kitchen was stocked with musicians that would go out and serve the pieces that were ordered. This would be going on simultaneously at all the other tables. Essentially, the group had set up a process. They had no idea how it would sound. They didn't decide what comes first and what comes next. They just set up the rules. Was this music? Did they compose music? In my opinion, the best filmmakers make films that ask questions instead of finding answers. And I think that's how I view John Cage's music. To me, it asks questions about the nature of music and its purpose. This is especially relevant when you consider how pervasive music is in human culture and throughout time. So what is music? Is it like the definition of pornography? You know it when you see it. Plato said, what should be the end of music if not the love of beauty? I'm guessing that pop music pushes the boundaries on that one. Not only does music reach us intellectually, socially, and emotional levels, but some describe it as a spiritual or mystical experience. So what is music? Biomusicologists have found significant structural similarities between human music and the songs of whales and birds. UNC biomusicologist Patricia Gray wrote, "It is not known when the ancient art of making music first began. But if it is as ancient as some believe, this could explain why we find so much meaning and emotion in music. Even though we cannot explain why it makes us feel that way. It does, the way it does, sorry about that. Such an impenetrable vagueness about this most basic of human creations seems to signal that the roots of music lie closer to our ancestral lizard brains than to our more recent reasoning cortex. That music was more ancient origin than even human language. I personally have no idea what a biomusicologist is. But I wouldn't be surprised if music predates language. I wouldn't be surprised if a number of animals produce music that we don't perceive as music. What purpose does it serve? Could we not be better off if we redirected all that time and energy towards something that was a little more constructive? Confucius said, "Music produces a kind of pleasure which human nature cannot do without." Plato said, "Rhythm and harmony find their way into the inward places of the soul." John Black said, Evolutionary scientists believe that musical culture, would have helped prehistoric humans, species to survive because the music coordinates emotions, helps important messages to be communicated, motivates people to identify with a group, and motivate individuals to support other group members. Here are the closing words. The Oxford Dictionary defines music as vocal or instrumental sounds, or both, combined in such a way as to produce beauty of form, harmony, expression of emotion. Mr. Cage said, "When I hear what we call music, it seems to me that someone is talking. And talking about his feelings and or his ideas or relationships. But when I hear traffic, the sound of traffic here on 6th Avenue, I don't have the feeling that anyone is talking. I have the feeling that sound is acting, and I love the activity of sound. I don't need sound to talk to me." Thank you very much. This time to greet your neighbors and friends and people sitting next to you. Thank you very much for coming to the service.